Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 745, Wiki Fascism Part 2. This program is being recorded on June 12th of the year 2011. We're going to plunge right in where we left off at the conclusion of Side 1. We've been taking a look at the role of Nazis and fascists and anti-Semites with the establishment of the WikiLeaks milieu in Sweden. It appears to have been fundamental to the establishment of WikiLeaks operations in Sweden, and indeed Julian Assange's own statements have indicated something of a reflexive doctrinaire anti-Semitism with an inclination to Jew bait just about anybody who he feels is warranting criticism. Again, that's characteristic of a Nazi point of view. The possibility that Julian Assange may be some sort of mind control Nazi is something that we will look at the end of this side, time permitting. A very incisive blog called Extreme Liberals Blog of May 7th of 2011 had a very important post. Did Bradley Manning almost blow the operation to capture or kill bin Laden? And what should be noted here is that the release of the Gitmo papers might very well have compromised the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden. It's not to say I hold a brief for the things that were done down at Gitmo or torturing people in any size, shape, form, or manner, but releasing a bunch of files, the content of which you don't know, a bunch of classified files, the content of which you are ignorant, which appears to have been something that Bradley Manning did, isn't going to help anything. It's not going to help to neutralize or prevent torture. It isn't going to expose wrongdoing necessarily. It can lead to something truly horrible. And in this case, it might very well have blunted the operation against bin Laden, something that no doubt would have been very pleasing to Karl Rove, currently holding forth in Sweden. And again, in this particular post, two important things. One, the possibility that the Bradley Manning releases and the WikiLeaks releases were involved in that they compromised the intelligence about the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden and the nature of Bradley Manning himself. Like WikiLeaks, he has been lionized in the so-called progressive sector. Appears to me to be a genuinely tragic fellow. He appears to have been manipulated. He's young. And like a lot of young folks, has a lot of difficulties, a lot of issues, I guess, is the popular phrase, and appears to have been manipulated in a very cynical fashion. But it appears that Bradley Manning is not a whistleblower, and that a lot of the stuff he released did not necessarily involve the knowledge of and exposure of wrongdoing. From the Extreme Liberals blog of May 7th of 2011. Now, how can Bradley Manning be connected to the release of the Gitmo papers? Well, let's take a look at his own words as he laid bare his actions to Adrian Lamo, courtesy of Wired.com. Then there's an excerpt of an interview with Adrian Lamo and Bradley Manning. Manning, the JTF, Joint Terrorism Task Force, Gitmo papers. Assange has those, too. Lamo, Reddit. Lamo, anything else interesting on his table as a former collector of interesting.com info? Manning, I don't know. What do you consider the highlights? Manning, the Guarani airstrike videos in full report, Iraq war event log, and the Gitmo papers and State Department cable database. Lamo, not too shabby. Manning, that's just me. Manning, I don't know about the rest. He hopefully has more. And then the blogger here goes on to comment, none of the other WikiLeaks releases have named Bradley Manning as the source of the classified intel, since by doing so, WikiLeaks would be providing evidence that Manning was the source of the material and thus would be acting as a witness against him in his upcoming trial. He is charged with violating the Espionage Act, among other serious charges. It isn't just me who thinks it's pretty obvious that these documents came through Manning. Andy Greenberg at Forbes says this, as with the last four major releases from WikiLeaks, imprisoned Army Private Bradley Manning remains the suspected source of the leak. In a chat with confidant Adrian Lamo, published by Wired.com last year, Lamo asks which of the documents he's leaked Manning deems most important. He lists, quote, the Guarani airstrike videos in full report, Iraq war event log, the Gitmo papers, and State Department cable database, unquote. all of those files, other than the Guarani airstrike video, a clip that purportedly shows more than 100 civilians being killed in Afghanistan by American forces, have now been released, unquote. The Gitmo files, which WikiLeaks began releasing daily on April 24th of 2011, came directly from Department of Defense classified intelligence databases and are of the same classified categorical designations as other Department of Defense and State Department intelligence cables previously released by WikiLeaks. The above-cited Gitmo file was specifically classified as secret, no foreign. The classified category of secret, no foreign means that any intel labeled as such should not ever be seen by any foreign government personnel or citizens. There was a reason this intel was classified. Releasing any of this intelligence would likely compromise top-secret operations in the planning stage or those on the verge of being executed. This is all background for what comes next. The Osama bin Laden operation and the connection to the release of the Gitmo files. My first visit to Osborne, Inc. was when I clicked on a link in a Bradley Manning story. I've been a regular since then. A few days ago, Matt put a post up that asked a great question to the defenders of Bradley Manning, the Homwaldians, as he calls them, from Osborne, Inc. Quote, if Bradley Manning had blown the bin Laden operation, would the Homwaldians still be advocating his release? It's a fair question, because when Manning allegedly put those 100,000-plus cables on his thumb drive, he certainly had not read them all. In fact, it's pretty certain Manning had no idea what was in them and no clue how many potential ops might get blown by their release. If he had blown the op and allowed bin Laden to get away, would he still be a hero? My opinion of Bradley Manning's massive data dump has always been that it isn't whistleblowing. How could releasing documents that you haven't even read be whistleblowing? It cannot be. The act that protects whistleblowers is pretty specific. And then quoting from Wikipedia, a source that has to be very judiciously sourced, by the way. You have to be very careful about Wikipedia. There's a lot of garbage in there, but something like this is pretty straightforward. The alleged misconduct may be classified in many ways. For example, a violation of a law, rule, regulation, and or a direct threat to public interest, such as fraud, health and safety violations, and corruption. Whistleblowers may make their allegations internally, for example, to other people within the accused organization, or externally to regulators, law enforcement agencies, to the media, or to groups concerned with the issues, unquote. What Manning did was to expose to the entire world, friends and foes, information that overwhelmingly was not any violation of law, regulation, etc. He leaked diplomatic and top-secret sensitive information as well as frivolous and stupid stuff. And his defenders, Glenn Greenwald, Jane Hampshire, and Greg Mitchell, think he is an innocent man, going so far as to say he is a hero and should be released. While the extent that these people will go to try to hurt the President of the United States' reputation, accusing him of torturing Manning because he was in solitary confinement is unbelievable. Is it that hard to understand that the Defense Department might want to put a man who bragged about how many files he was copying, with no concern for what impact it might have on his country's security and defense, in solitary confinement? From the government's perspective, I imagine this kid is the worst spy they've ever seen. By the way, everyone in max security at Quantico is housed by themselves in their own cell. I've posted about his conditions in the past. Go here to get caught up on that if needed. In your mind, was this kid a hero? Then the blog goes on to describe specifically what information in the Gitmo files, apparently released by Bradley Manning to WikiLeaks and then made public, perhaps compromising the potential operation against Osama bin Laden, and thereby removing some political capital from Barack Obama. The blog goes on to set this forth in a section called The Connection. So the other night I'm on Twitter, and one of my fellow bloggers, who prefers to remain nameless, put up a couple of links in a post. I dutifully clicked on them and saw this short article on The Guardian's website detailing information from one of the latest WikiLeaks of Gitmo files. Here is the paragraph and sentence that caught my eye. According to the document, Libby fled to Peshawar in Pakistan and was living there in 2003 when he asked to become one of bin Laden's messengers. The document says, quote, "In July of 2003, detainee received a letter from bin Laden's designated courier, Malawi Abd al-Khaliq John, requesting detainee take on the responsibility of collecting donations, organizing travel, and distributing funds for families in Pakistan. Bin Laden stated detainee would be the official messenger between bin Laden and the others in Pakistan. In mid-2003, detainee moved his family to Abbottabad, Pakistan, and worked between Abbottabad and Peshawar," unquote. WikiLeaks released the report last week, prompting speculation that the U.S., afraid that its planned raid might be preempted, brought forward its attack. And then the blogger goes on to comment, "I actually typed an exclamation, no expletive deleted. I had just read a description of what looked like the the exact evidence that led to locating Osama bin Laden. How does that read to you, knowing what you know now about how we got Osama bin Laden? My jaw was on my chest. Here is a link to the actual leaked document. The pertinent information contained in this WikiLeaks release is found on page 5 in the paragraph starting with S/NF in October 2002, unquote, which reveals that the Department of Defense had both the name of bin Laden's courier and the city where bin Laden was living. Considering that WikiLeaks began releasing the Gitmo files on April 24th, and that we now know that President Obama signed the order to begin this operation on Friday, April 29th, to originally be carried out the following day on Saturday, there was just 5 days from the point at which WikiLeaks released the pertinent classified intelligence and when the president signed off on the Osama bin Laden capture-kill mission. This substantially supports the possibility that the classified intelligence Bradley Manning is charged with removing from Department of Defense classified databases and then passing to WikiLeaks may very well have caused the White House to step up the operation to get Osama bin Laden. Can you just imagine how our president and his national security team felt when they saw that document get released by WikiLeaks after tracking and planning this mission since August?" Unquote. I would note that, once again, coming back to Jermas/Shamir, he was writing about these very same documents just before the operation, or basically in late April of 2000. And actually, he would have been writing about it at this point. It became public in Counterpunch on May 4th. And again, I think it speaks volumes about just how utterly foul the so-called progressive sector has become, where you have somebody like Alexander Coburn, or Alexander Cockroach, as I call him, utilizing an overt Nazi sympathizer and anti-Semite and Holocaust denier in order to further his, that is to say, Coburn's political agenda. Not really all that surprising, I guess, in light of the way things have been going, but pretty disgusting nonetheless. In Counterpunch of May 4th of 2011, "Cross and double cross with Gitmo files. U.S. knew where Osama was since 2005. Again, trying to cast aspersions on the neutralization of Osama bin Laden. Something that garnered President Obama a little bit of political capital, something that he could certainly use if he's going to be able to stave off who knows what the GOP nuts are going to do, but they may very well wind up collapsing the U.S. and perhaps the global economy if they continue to play chicken over the raising of the debt limit and the budget. But we will see what Shamir/Jermas was writing about for Alexander Coburn's Counterpunch was exactly what the extreme liberal blog was talking about. An excerpt. "The unredacted Guantanamo files show clearly that the trail to Abbottabad was known to the intelligence services at least since 2005, when Al-Libi, another Abbottabad dweller, was captured." Exactly when they knew, it remains to be seen. Certainly the capture was in 2005. Raises a number of interesting questions, including what what exactly was Joran Jermas doing with this particular information? Was he working? Is he working with Karl Rove? And certainly that tends to make that type of disclosure tends to weaken President Obama's position. One of the relatively few things that Obama had going for him was the neutralization of Osama bin Laden. In light of the relationship between the Bush and bin Laden families, one can only wonder whether the Bush administration, I don't think George Bush, but whether the Bush administration itself may have been reluctant to act, even if Osama bin Laden's presence was known. Certainly, the intelligence that yielded that analysis was generated in 2005. Exactly when that became known is anybody's guess. But it is more than a little interesting to see Joran Jermas, a.k.a. Israel Shamir, accessing exactly that information for Alexander Coburn's counterpunch. One of the things that we've looked at in connection with September 11th, one of the many aspects of that investigation that has gone essentially undiscussed, and that is the many Nazi and fascist connections to September 11th, including a program in the 1990s, a shortwave radio broadcast by William Luther Pierce, the author of the Turner Diaries and the head of the National Alliance. And in the 1990s, he said, quote, "The people in New York who live in buildings the size of the World Trade Center should wear hard hats and that Osama bin Laden was coming." And he also said that the U.S. would be hit by biological warfare attacks. This, again, in the 1990s. The climactic episode of the Turner Diaries is a low-level suicide aerial attack on the Pentagon. The Turner Diaries were authored by William Luther Pierce. That's just one of a number of interesting Nazi and fascist connections to September 11th that has gone totally uninvestigated or underinvestigated. It is more than a little interesting to see WikiLeaks taking this basically WikiLeaks winding up in Sweden under the auspices of what is essentially a Nazi and fascist milieu, although many elements of it, such as the Anonymous folks and the Pirate Bay folks, are unaware, no doubt, of the real nature of the beasts with whom they are associating. Certainly the Pirate Bay folks and Anonymous are anything but fascist, but they have not exactly counted their buttons before doing them up, and they wound up working with and on behalf of a Nazi data mining and propaganda operation. I would note that the servers in Sweden, initially anyway, that were housing the WikiLeaks operation were the Pirate Bay servers financed in part, in large measure, by Carl Lundstrom. According to my Silicon Valley sources, that basically would have given the Carl Lundstrom milieu all access to all of the information that was on WikiLeaks servers, including classified information about the U.S. military. By the way, William Pierce, the author of the Turner Diaries, also authored Serpent's Walk, and what that is about is a Nazi takeover of the United States after a series of terrorist incidents using weapons of mass destruction that are brought in through the drug importation networks. And the SS goes underground and infiltrates the U.S. military and winds up taking over the U.S. after a declaration of martial law. Certainly having access to the social security numbers of active duty American military personnel could be seen as furthering just such a serpent's walk scenario. Now, again, I've noted that Julian Assange himself is a pretty strange bird. And in For the Record 724, I noted the distinct possibility that Julian Assange was actually a member of the Santa Kenton and Park Association, or the family of Anne Hamilton Byrne. He claims that he was opposed to this cult and that he and his mother spent X number of years on the run from this cult, although a careful examination of his mother's behavior, she told people where they were going while they were on the run, kept going to the same places, and surprise, surprise, the cult kept catching up with them. It may have been that she simply lacked resources and imagination, or it may have been that she was actually setting up what is known as a legend, a potentially credible stance of being opposed to this cult, whereas she and Julian were actually associated with that very cult. Again, the hair, the strange hair that Assange has, and that type of hair is something that the members of the cult were forced to adopt. Well, that raised a number of questions. Also, look on the front page of the Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com. There is a picture of a member of the Santa Ketan and Park Association, the family of Anne Hamilton Byrne, that has a distinct resemblance to Julian Assange. I am not myself expert in photo analysis, but it certainly looks like Assange. I got a hunch it actually is Assange, though perhaps it's his half-brother. In returning to the book Inside WikiLeaks by Daniel Domscheit-Berg, there's a curious... A very curious aspect here, and I'm going to read an aspect of the Anne Hamilton Byrne cult, and that concerns the nannies. Now, as we looked at in For the Record 724, the aunties, I should say, the Santa Ketan and Park Association, the family of Anne Hamilton Byrne, gives every indication of being an intelligence-connected mind control cult. They practice a very rigorous form of mind control on its adherents. They use children who are sleep-deprived, sensorily deprived, and then they're administered LSD and sexually molested and tortured, just some truly horrible things. And the nature of this particular cult was set forth by a woman named Sarah Moore, who was a member of the group. And the motto of the cult was that they are unseen, unheard, and unknown. And she describes the cult: I suspect that there were more sinister motives than these alone. Some of us had multiple birth certificates and passports and citizenship of more than one country. Only she, Anne Hamilton Byrne, knows why this was and why we were also all dressed alike, why most of us even had our hair dyed identically blonde. I can only conjecture because I will never know for sure. However, I suspect that she went to such great lengths in order to enable her to move children around in and out of the country, perhaps even to be sold overseas. I'm sure there was a market somewhere in the world for small blonde children with no traceable identities. If she did it, it was a perfect scam. Many ex-sect members have said that they were aware that Anne was creating children by a breeding program, unquote, in the late 1960s. These were invisible kids because they had no papers and there is no proof that they ever existed. Yet we Hamilton Byrne children had multiple identities. These identities could perhaps have been loaned to other children and the similarity of our appearance used to cover up their absence. One little blonde kid looks very like another in a passport photo. I don't suppose we will ever know the truth because only Anne Hamilton Byrne knows the truth about the whole affair, and the truth is something she will never tell. And skipping down, we read, one of the elements of this particular cult, the children were dealt with very horribly, but the aunties figure very large. The adult male members were called uncles, and the aunties, adult female members of the cult, had a controlling role in the cult. They administered brutal corporal punishment to the children in the cult, and they were basically authority figures. And Morrow goes on to describe, while we were doing our yoga, most of the aunties were upstairs having their breakfast. They got tea and toast. They also read a daily affirmation from a book called God Calling. Sometimes one auntie was left downstairs to keep an eye on us or who would wash our clothes. They also administered physical discipline as well, talking about one woman named Megan Dawes. Skipping down, she was locked in a cot all day with the sides up. She had not reached the walking stage and so couldn't get out of the cot and get to the toilet. However, that didn't stop the aunties. She still got belted for soiling herself when she got wet or dirtied her nappy. And then one auntie named Trish would beat this infant extraordinarily. Skipping down. Extraordinary measures were taken to prevent us from stealing food. The kitchen cupboards were padlocked. There was a chain and padlock around the fridge, and an auntie was delegated to guard the kitchen all the time. Amazingly, despite these measures, we were sometimes successful in stealing food. But more often than not, the ever-vigilant aunties noticed immediately if anything was missing. Aunties, by the way, is in capital letters. Now, there's a very strange passage in Inside WikiLeaks by Daniel Domscheit-Berg, and I'm going to read this to you. And the question I'm asking is the nanny here one of the aunties? Skipping down in Inside WikiLeaks, In September of 2009, Julian got the nanny, unquote, involved. The nanny was brought in whenever there was a job that Julian couldn't be bothered with or couldn't do himself. She sometimes arrived just before conferences to write his speeches. After other people and I left WikiLeaks, she was also the one who ended up traveling the world mediating between Julian and us and asking us not to damage the project by publicly criticizing it. The nanny was an old friend of Julian's and was around 40, a pleasant but very resolute sort of person. For personal reasons I don't want to go into here, she would never want to talk about her contact with WikiLeaks. That was likely a particular advantage she offered from Julian's perspective. At any rate, the nanny had our American volunteer at his wit's end. What made the matter worse was that the time zones in which the two of them lived were so far apart that communication was only possible for one during the potential deep sleep phase of the other. In addition, our poor volunteer was sick of describing the whole problem over and over again. In the end, a journalist I knew from the New York Times came to the rescue. Anyway, who is this nanny that was brought in by Julian Assange to oversee key sensitive aspects of the WikiLeaks operation? I mean, he's a grown man. They don't have nannies. I have a hunch, and this is, I want to stress, pure conjecture. I got a hunch the nanny is one of the aunties. Another aspect of the Ann Hamilton Byrne cult, and that concerns a quasi-Nazi or quasi-eugenics viewpoint that the cult had. And that is described by Anne Morrow. As for us, Anne wanted people to believe we were her children, and she thought that she was beautiful, so that it was a certainty that she screened us on our looks, or at least screened our parents. We were to be the ones who would carry on the work of the sect. We were a direct reflection on her, so she was intimately concerned about our appearances, and she used to talk a lot about breeding and talk about us being from the right stock, unquote. Again, a quasi-eugenics and Nazi viewpoint. And this, again, one of the things I'm going to note in the description to the program, and that is that Julian Assange himself began to manifest methodology and vocabulary very characteristic of spooks and of intelligence officers. And again, John Young, one of the original founders of WikiLeaks turned a critic, noted that they were acting like a bunch of spies. They were acting like a government. That's in For the Record 725. But note again the emphasis on breeding and coming from the right stock in the Ann Hamilton Byrne cult. Returning to Inside WikiLeaks, we, meaning Domscheit, Berg, and Assange, often discuss the theory of evolution. If he did have faith in anything, it was the theory of evolution. Julian thought that the stronger members of the species not only prevailed, but produced heirs who were better able to survive. Naturally, in his view, his genes particularly deserved to be reproduced. Often I sat in larger groups and listened to Julian boast about how many children he had fathered in various parts of the world. He seemed to enjoy the idea of lots and lots of little Julians, one on every continent. Whether he took care of any of these alleged children or whether they existed at all was another question. Well, again, I'm wondering, are these some of the kids from the cult? Are these some of these children with multiple identities and multiple passports? Anyone's guess, but who was the nanny that Julian Assange brought in to help oversee some of WikiLeaks' operations? Again, a very, very strange organization, but one whose totalitarian and Nazi character is beginning to emerge. And it's funny because that is in complete, it's the exact opposite of the public persona of WikiLeaks. And boy, are the people in the so-called progressive sector being taken for a ride here. However, more about this in the description, because this concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 745, Wiki-Fascism Part 2. This has been recorded on June 12th of the year 2011. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.